From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 25th day of August, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets. Paul Cooley will be here from ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Climbers facility that belongs to the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. In agricultural news for the day, farmland sales are picking up, and so are the prices. Sanderson Farms has resumed poultry exports to Russia, and if you were wondering just how it could be that all that out-of-condition corn was being stored in New Orleans for export, there isn't any storage capacity at the Gulf to speak of. Well, Dave Dickey will tell you how it's all happening and update the rest of our news stories, too. Hey, sound the alarm. That rainfall that Peoria caught last week, well, it's created a big problem in the area. I'll tell you just what in our feature story for the day. And then as we close out the first half hour of the program, we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City about the agricultural weather forecast right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby September wheat at $6.47¾, down 27. December at $6.80½, down 27¼. September hard red from Kansas City at $6.76¼, down 24½ cents. Back in Chicago from the corn pit, a half cent loss today at $4.04¾ for the September contract. December futures at $4.20 for the corn, a half lower. March at $4.33¾, down a half, and the May at $4.41¼, down a quarter. July corn at $4.47¾, 1/2 cent lower. Soybeans now, September contract, $10, a half cent higher for the day. November at $9.99, unchanged. January beans at $10.07, up a quarter. The March at $10.11, up a half. And May at $10.12½, down, or rather up 1¼ for the day. September bean meal at $2.99.70, up $3.30. September bean oil at $39.14, down 34. August live cattle futures, 98.60, 87½ lower. The August feeders at $114.75, up 15 cents. And the October lean hogs today at $77.10, 17½ cents lower for 100 pounds. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, September trading at $72.68 a barrel. That's up a dollar and a nickel. And the ethanol at $1.85 is up 2 1/10 cents. Natural gas at $3.87 7/10, down 16 2/10. The diesel fuel or heating oil at $1.97½, up 4 cents on the day. And the gold futures at $1,239.50, up $7.70 a troy ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just above 10,000 at 10,060, just about 20 points higher. U.S. dollar at 83.26. is up 0.11 on the afternoon. The CRB index, 261.80, down 0.66. Here's what the weather forecast for the local region looks like around Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. Sunny skies, a high near 79 degrees today. North-northwest winds between 9 and 11 miles an hour. It'll be gusting up to as high as 15 miles an hour. Tonight should be clear, a low around 52 degrees. North-northwest winds tonight between 5 and 8 miles an hour. And then tomorrow, sunny skies again, a high near 78. Northeast winds at 6 miles an hour. And tomorrow night, clear, a low around 54. East-northeast winds between 3 and 5 miles an hour. Friday day should be sunny, high near 82. Southeast winds between 3 and 6, and Friday night finally clear for football, low of about 58 degrees. Saturday sunny, a high of 87. Saturday night clear, a low of 64. Sunday sunny with a high of 88. Sunday night, 66 degrees for the low and mostly clear. Next week, sunny on Monday and on Tuesday, the highs of 88 and 89 degrees, the low a bit higher than it has been for the previous week of around 67 degrees. More on the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of this half hour.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tom Testale in Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. On the phone line for Wednesday afternoon to take a look at the futures markets, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. Good, beautiful afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
What are you hearing from your clients in the South and other places about their crops? And have you heard any field reports for harvest?
Yeah, I think the verdict of a smaller kernel size in corn is true. I think there's the idea that maybe the government overestimated the crop production report is true. And, so those things, the moisture level, you know, yesterday 19% moisture corn coming in this afternoon at 17.5. So the moisture drop is big. Now, we haven't had any beans here, but the Crawfordsville area is coming in, and I get the feeling that expected yields on the beans there. Now, the one thing that we are picking up is that the harvest is going to be a couple of weeks early, mainly in the corn. Usually, of course, everybody starts harvesting soybeans first, but the corn's coming in, and I think there's a ready market for it, and, the pipelines will react accordingly.
Yeah, basis really hasn't picked up much. I mean, hasn't narrowed down, waiting for that corn much. Does that surprise you at all?
Well, there's monumental bets here, about the transportation. You know, you book trains to show up at a certain time frame, and processors want corn and soybeans at certain times. We understand, I think at St. Louis, the basis broke 20 cents on soybeans. But I think the rule is, with this amount of export bookings as we understand is there, the amount of demand that will be showing up, I don't think that we're going to have to worry about basis widening. I think we're going to hear the word basis tightening for a couple of reasons. Drier crops mean we can put them away pretty fast. They're easy to handle. You can go to the outside storage. And, you know, one thing about the major grain exporters today, they know how to handle bulk commodities better than anybody else in the world, and they can make things happen.
Do you think the corn crop is as good today as it was a week ago? Has it been
shrinking
in your mind?
No, I don't. I think it's a smaller crop. I think that our sources indicate that it was a smaller crop in Indiana, not a larger one like some of the reporting services indicated. So no, I think I think the crop ratings last week indicated a better Illinois corn crop. I think they made a mistake. I think it's a smaller crop.
I think Indiana, and I'm not quite certain about this, I'll need to check with the statistician somewhere along the line, may have the driest season on record since
July. Indianapolis was one of the drier.
I'm thinking for the last 50 years.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's been really dry, surprisingly so. I've got to go back and look that up, so don't take that one with a grain of salt. We'll see whether that's right or not. What should the producer be thinking at this point then?
Well, when we look at, the world picture, we see Russian crop last year, 97 million tons, this year 60. Ukraine 45, this year 40.4, the German crop 49.7, this year 43.9. So we are seeing, a very major drop in production levels. The other factor is, of course, rain forecasted for the winter wheat area of Russia, and also Egypt bought wheat from Canada and also France, and those were a couple of reasons why the market went down. But I think my real point is, I think corn has fair value here. I don't think we're looking at any 20 or 40 cent dip at the present time in corn. I think if you haven't done your marketing, I think a good bin full of corn will pay a reward.
So sell 20,000?
Well, I did. I sold a quarter of the my recommendation was a quarter of the corn at $4 out of the field or $4.24 in January. I think that's a good sale. I would have replaced it here the last 2 days at, you know, $4.19. The rest of it, I think, can be carried into it. I've been an advocate of selling $10 beans out of the field, and I am looking very carefully about replacing that commodity at an opportune time.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Have a profitable day.
You too. That's Paul Cooley. He's with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. If you'd like to hear what Paul had to say again, you can always do that on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. We post everything that we produce during the day to that website not long after it is aired. That coming from the pre-opening market report all the way through the closing market report, and of course, including our weekend program. We call it Commodity Week. It's all at willag.org for you to listen to on demand anytime you'd like.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Dave Dickey is here. He'll take us through the agricultural news for the afternoon. Of course, Dave, the director of ag programming here at willag.org.
In agricultural news, agriculture land brokers today say that sales of U.S. farmland are picking up, with rising commodity prices and aggressive bidders helping to drive increasing land values. Lloyd Brown, president of Hertz Farm Management, says prices are ranging over $8,000 an acre for high-performing cropland in Iowa and Illinois, and are up more than 5% in some areas over last quarter. Data released earlier this month by the Federal Bank Reserve of Kansas City showed the value of farmland in the U.S. Central Plains rising nearly 4% in the second quarter. The pace of farmland sales is expected to further pick up heading into the fall and winter as row crops are cleared from fields. Sanderson Farm today says that it has resumed chicken exports to Russia, one of the first U.S. companies to confirm shipping to that market since Russian authorities banned U.S. poultry in January. Sanderson Chief Executive Joe Sanderson called potential Russian demand, quote, spectacular. In the first quarter of 2010, the U.S. shipped just under 34,000 metric tons of chicken to Russia, down nearly 80% from the same period a year earlier. Russia banned imports of U.S. chickens in January because of a chlorine rinse disinfectant used in the U.S., but it has lifted that prohibition on some plants that have switched to other disinfectants. The early corn harvest is expected to provide exporters at the U.S. Gulf with fresh supplies to blend with millions of bushels of subpar corn from last year. Trade sources say 25 to 35 million bushels of poor quality corn are being stored on barges by exporters waiting for new crop supplies to arrive at their terminals. Much of the corn now at the Gulf is number three or worse, with test weights at 52 pounds or below. Euro Agro Consult today says that it has revised down its grain crop forecast for Ukraine to 40.4 million tons in 2010 from 41.2 million a month earlier. The government says that the grain crop is likely to total up to 41 million tons compared to 46 million in 2009. Euro Agro Consult says it has cut its forecast for wheat harvest to 17.5 million tons from 17.8 million last month. Meanwhile, Ukraine today says that it has put off introducing curbs on grain exports because the world market has settled after Russia's export ban in the Ukrainian home market was no longer threatened by demand from abroad. But Ukrainian customs continue to enforce de facto export restrictions by blocking grain shipments from seaports on the grounds that cargoes had been wrongly labeled. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week. You can find both programs on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Now, up next, you know downy mildew is threatening the late-planted pumpkin crop in Illinois. And while it isn't likely to have an enormous impact on the nation's supply of pumpkin pie filling, Illinois produces about 95% of the U.S. supply of processing pumpkins in the Peoria, Illinois area. It is a great big problem for the growers and the processors. Pumpkin harvest in Illinois has been underway for nearly a month. Given the outbreak of downy mildew, that's a very, very good thing, says University of Illinois plant pathologist Mohamed Babadoust. He says the disease is not a problem for pumpkins to be harvested in the first couple of weeks of September, but is sounding the alarm for the later season crop.
In fact, my first contact was with the processing pumpkin companies. They handle all the field work and harvesting. They have been harvesting for almost 1 month. But because of the early season rainfalls, they have some fields planted late in June. Still they're growing. Probably they will grow until end of September, and they have to spray those fields, not the fields already harvesting, or those fields probably will be harvested in a couple weeks. Those are okay. We don't need to spray them. But any other field likely grow more than 2 weeks from now, they need to be sprayed.
Downy mildew spreads northward in the United States, and up until the rains fell in the Peoria, Illinois area over the 20th of August, Babadoust thought the crop was safe. Almost all the processing pumpkins in the U.S. are grown, harvested, and processed in the 7-county area around the River City. They're used to make pumpkin pie filling. Babadoust says it is essential farmers protect their late-season pumpkin crop.
Farmers have to spray right away, immediately. And we do have a few good fungicides, including Revis, Tanis, Runman, and Privacure Flex. At least four of them are very effective at this stage, but they have to mix them with another fungicide called chlorotolenol, known as Bravo.
The U of I plant pathologist says it is imperative to treat the late-season pumpkin crop today and then again at weekly intervals. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Leonard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Leonard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Leonard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. It is a Wednesday afternoon. Time to check in on the cash grain market. The folks up at the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana, are on the phone line. Matt Kunisch is with us. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Afternoon.
Farmers cleaning their bins out and getting ready for an early harvest?
Yes, they are. Feels like guys are getting pretty well cleaned up now. Still talking to a lot of guys in this area, at least, sounds like they're going to let the corn stand in the field a little longer than they normally would, just to let Mother Nature dry it down a little more compared to last year, where they paid quite a bit for the drying fees. Looks like beans will be ready early, and that's what looks like is going to come out first.
Oh, really? I'm surprised by that. When do you think it'll happen?
Around this area, we have a little bit of a area where it does go early for Indiana, at least I would say 7 days, and we'll be starting to hit it about 10 to 13 days out, we'll be running full bore by then, I think.
From Purdue and West Lafayette, you're how far and which direction?
About 35 miles northeast.
Northeast, that's what I was thinking. And you're in really kind of a bean belt right there, right? Some of the best.
There are quite a few beans with Frankfurt, ADM Frankfurt, Cargill Lafayette to the south by about 35 to, 48 miles. And then Claypool, 50 miles north of us, so we're kind of right in that area where it's very very opportune to grow beans.
And what kind of yields are producers expecting for both corn and beans?
I would still say average this year, maybe a slightly above average. Could have used a rain to help finish them out a little bit. I don't think that's going to happen though. In this area, I mean, really good yields anywhere from. Average yields 48 to 53, a good yield 60.
Processors earlier in the year were hunting beans up. I suspect that's still the case. Is basis good?
Basis is good and getting stronger. There were a few processors that came up about 30 cents today. I believe that trend to continue until they get once Labor Day hits and after. I believe they'll be getting enough of a flow where they'll go to their fall bid within days after.
Then are they over at this point?
I'm sorry, what's
that? Are they paying overs at this point? Or
oh,
not?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, still, yes.
Yeah, anywhere from 50 to 65 over right now.
And so you've got bids 10 and a half or better?
Yep.
Wow. And producers probably would like to have beans to let go, but I suspect there aren't many out there.
They're getting close, but like I said, around here they're not going to let the beans sit for that kind of premium. They'll get in and get them out pretty quickly.
How's the ethanol plant operating today?
Well, it's not. It's our planned shutdown for maintenance.
That's funny.
but actually everything's going well. We're ready to get rolling here, and I believe up here we'll probably see corn in another 10 days also.
I suspect that you're hopping to get rolling because margins are pretty decent at this point. Did you make money on the ethanol plant all year, or was there a time where it was really thin?
There was a point, I don't want to say that's back in a late winter, early spring,
February.
That was a little tight, but really for the most part, it's been in the green and the black. So, no complaints by any means.
Okay. What do you expect corn basis to do as we head into harvest?
Really this area, we went from like a 20 under to basically a 40 under now. I believe it'll probably weaken up just because maybe a nickel to a dime more just because of the amount of corn that is ready to come off at the same time. However, I think in this area we'll be done with harvest third week of October, and then November will be a premium just because by then, usually we'll see harvest then, where this year it'll be over and we'll have to entice bushels to come in late November, December. I think those time periods will stay firm.
And what are your bids for the dime?
Let's see here. Corn here at Climbers tonight at 388, and new crop corn at 388 also. Delphi beans at 1009 tonight.
Good to talk with you, Matt. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Kunisch is with the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Back in 2 minutes when we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. You can always hear all of our report online anytime you'd like at willag.org.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's National Banana Split Day. It's also Feast of St. Louis the Ninth, patron of distillers. On this day in agricultural history in 1840, Joseph Gibbons received a patent for a seeding machine. In 1900, Sir Hans Adolf Krebs was born. A German-born British biochemist, he received the Nobel Prize for the discovery in living organisms of the series of chemical reactions known as the citric acid cycle, the basic system for the essential pathway of oxidation within the cell. In 1921, Peter Cooper Hewitt died, an American electrical engineer. He invented the mercury vapor lamp, an important forerunner of fluorescent lamps. And in 1935, Curtis Fletcher Marbot died, an American geologist and one of the founders of modern soil science. He taught geology at the University of Missouri while also working for the Missouri Geological Survey and directing the Missouri Soil Survey. In 1910, he left Missouri and he was the soil scientist for the U.S. Bureau of Soils for the balance of his life. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the closing market report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated joins us from Kansas City. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It is one gorgeous day here. It's supposed to be really nice all week, with the exception that I think some would like some rainfall. Still nothing in the forecast that I see.
Boy, there really isn't much rain in the forecast. It is awful nice and refreshing, though, to feel that lower humidity out there. It's all over the Midwest. I know that the concern is the rainfall for many areas, especially in Indiana and southeastern Illinois and off over into Ohio and Michigan, even down into the Delta. You know, pretty serious dryness underway, a lot of stress going on. The temperatures we have out there right now are certainly helping to ease that a little bit, or at least reduce the intensity of it. But as we go forward through this next week, we will not only see a continuation of dry weather, but we'll also bring back warmer temperatures. So that by the time we get to the end of the weekend and early part of next week, we'll be looking at temperatures that are back into the upper 80s and lower to possibly a few middle 90s. So that's going to make it a little bit more stressful for these crop areas. And there is not a meaningful amount of rainfall slated for the eastern half of the Midwest through at least the first part of next week.
I just took a look at the temperatures. It's 81 degrees here, and you suggested it feels good. Actually, the feels-like temperature outside our station is just 80 degrees, so it really is really nice out there. But we're a little dry. You talked about that. Is that going to create a problem, do you think, for the crop? Are we far enough along?
Well, I do think that the soybean crops in differing parts of the region will be hurt by this. We're certainly hearing a lot of commentary out of Indiana that the situation there has really gotten out of hand, so to speak. The situation is really quite dry. There's a lot of stress going on, and soybean yields are coming down. I've heard similar comments come from Ohio, although I have a hard time believing that the situation in Ohio is at a critical point, not like Indiana, which has been dry for quite some time. But Ohio is certainly working in that same direction. Same is true for parts of Michigan, believe it or not. And there are other areas in Kentucky and southeast Missouri and southernmost Illinois and down into the Delta that were having a lot of trouble earlier on, got a little break for a while, and now it's all coming back again. So definitely a good drink of water is necessary. We are losing a little bit of yield potential in some areas, but we still have a very good crop off to the northwest, portions of central Missouri northward into Iowa, and portions of Wisconsin, Minnesota doing extremely well. And so a lot of the good yields there will help to counter whatever trouble we've got in the lower parts of the Midwest.
Yeah, I suppose we ought to define which regions of Indiana. That would be the southern, what, the southeastern or southwestern portion of Indiana?
Yeah, I think it'd probably be the central and southwestern sections. Kind of starts right in and around the Indianapolis area, to the west and south of the Indianapolis area, and it goes straight southward into the Evansville area. Although Evansville had some better timely rainfall than some of the other immediate neighboring areas there, but it's still dry, and it's still a very definite situation of concern.
Thanks much, Drew.
Have a good afternoon.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. You have a good day.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're going to talk with the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol. His name is Arnie Klon. Mr. Klon, thank you so much for being with us. Tell us about Blue Fire Ethanol. What makes it different than other types of ethanol plants?
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show, Todd. Blue Fire Ethanol is a cellulosic to ethanol type of company. Our technology makes us uniquely different in that we take a whole different approach to converting the cellulosic materials, breaking it down to its constituent components of sugar and lignin, and then producing that ethanol. And we do this by utilizing concentrated sulfuric acid. Basically, we decrystallize the sugar from the substrate lignin by using that acid as opposed to using, say, an enzymatic approach or, you know, some combination of enzymes and acids. And the reason why we do this has been proven, and when I say proven, we have over 10 years of operating experience in two different pilot plants here in Orange County, California, as well as we licensed the technology back in 2000 to a Japanese company called JGC Corporation, and JGC built a duplicate of our pilot plant in Japan, as well as a much larger pre-commercial scale plant that operated for over 4.5 years, converting wood waste, some agricultural residues, and other biomass products, breaking it down from its into its basic sugars into ethanol for the Japanese marketplace to demonstrate the efficacy of cellulosic ethanol. So we have a lot of runtime on our technology by various companies, not just ourselves, and we also have probably the highest yield that can be recovered from any type of biomass materials, whether it's the corn stover or, you know, agricultural crop residues or purpose-grown crops. So our technology is probably the most proven that is out there right now, and we achieve a very high rate of yield based on our technology.
You're one of just, I think, four companies maybe that the U.S. Department of Energy has awarded grants to construct commercial-scale cellulosic ethanol production facilities. Are you in the process of doing that?
Yes, we are. And we were one of four that did receive grants. We received $88 million from the USDA, primarily for a project that's located in Fulton, Mississippi. And that particular project, it's through its licensing phase. We've already kicked off engineering. We're getting ready to break ground this year, probably at the latest in September, doing the actual construction of the project. It's about a 19 million gallon a year ethanol plant, but it's going to be primarily processing wood waste and wood slash out of the forest. There's a tremendous amount of wood that's grown, you know, for the paper industry in that in the northern part of Mississippi where this plant's located. And so we're going to be taking all the off-spec woods and lumbers, and also we're going to be looking at agricultural residues. There's a lot of cotton grown down there and cotton stalks, and the seeds in that will be ideal, if you will, opportunistic feedstocks for us to convert that into ethanol also.
Now, much of our audience will be familiar with corn-based ethanol. How does cellulosic-based ethanol differ? And I understand you've got a way that you're doing this, but how does the plant itself differ in producing ethanol?
Well, it's pretty much the same, except the significant difference is in the front end, where with corn, clearly you're bringing the corn kernels in and then using either a wet mill or dry mill process to break it down to where you can get the starches out, and then those starches through enzymatic process go into a sugar that eventually gets fermented. In our case, what we have to do is we have to release the sugar molecules that basically are part of the cell structure in the agricultural residues. So instead of us bringing corn in, we would take the corn cob, we would take the stover, we would take, you know, the remaining portion of the plant that otherwise cannot be utilized for a food product or converting it into ethanol. We take that material in, and what we have to do is we have to, again, decrystallize or basically decompose the material in such a fashion that the C5 and C6 sugars that make up the vast majority of the plant are released from the glue that holds those sugars together, which is called lignin. And we do this, again, through a sulfuric acid process. And that's where the complexity is, not from a technical standpoint, but it takes several more steps than what you would have in a typical corn-based plant. So what we do is we initially get the material in, we size it, we grind it to a particular size, and then we spray sulfuric acid on it. And when I say spray, this is not really what you would consider a wet process by any stretch of the imagination. It's just enough sulfuric acid to wet the surface of the biomass material. Then we mechanically, if you will, blend that such that the overall surface and the material itself is coated with the sulfuric acid. At that point, we do add water. And it goes into about a 40-minute decrystallization phase before we take that material, we put it through what's called a filter press, which basically squeezes it, and that takes the liquids out. We wash that filter media several times to make sure all the sugars are extracted. And what's left over from the filter press is the lignin itself, which is now just pure lignin. It's a carbon form. We burn that in our boilers to generate our steam and electricity for the plant, and we're 100% in balance, energy balance at that point for the amount of steam and electricity we can generate what's needed to process, you know, through the whole plant. And then the liquid stream that's left over is actually composed of the acid and the sugars. We pioneered a methodology for separating the sugars from the acid, and we achieve about a 99% separation of the sugars from the acids. We reuse and recycle the acids in the process, so we have a closed system from that standpoint. The sugars at that point are aseptic, and they are also fairly acidic. We adjust the pH, and then we go into very conventional sugar to ethanol fermentation. So really where we match up with the corn plants is when you're in the fermentation stage. We finally get to that point where you could utilize our technology and use those sugars to go into, say, a conventional grain-based ethanol plant to produce the ethanol.
Is it competitive with pricing for ethanol? Does the lower price, and I'm going to assume the lower price of the stover or the cellulosic feedstock, make the pilot plant and the production facility close to the pricing for ethanol on the market at this point? Can you make it break even or make money?
Well, you definitely can get in parity with the corn-based ethanol at a certain size of facility. Every company has a different break-even point, though, because, you know, bear in mind, we are one of maybe 10 different types of technologies out there that can do this conversion of the cellulose, you know, or the basic feedstock, the conversion of that corn stover into the ethanol. In our case, we are competitive down to about a 4 million gallon a year ethanol plant. We can produce ethanol and still make money at that small scale. The pilot plants, to my knowledge, no one's pilot plant can make any money because it's just the scaling factors and yield versus the amount of manpower. We target in all the, again, we over our 10 years of operation in that, it would appear that we can be better than corn-based ethanol at about that 19 million gallon a year size plant, the one that we're doing in Mississippi. Our cost of production at our 4 million gallon a year ethanol facility that's going to be built in Lancaster, California, which, by the way, uses the residues, organic residues that we put into our landfills. This plant is located adjacent to an existing landfill, and we're going to be taking that woody biomass and paper waste and other organic fraction, converting that into ethanol. That can be competitive in the essence of being able to make money, but not on a pricing basis for the ethanol. The ethanol production cost is much higher in that smaller scale than, say, a conventional corn-based ethanol plant is.
How much water do you use? More than a conventional ethanol plant or less?
Actually less, mainly because a lot of water comes in with the feedstock, and so we're in a position where we have to dry the feedstock that is coming in, and we use the exhaust gases from our boilers to dry that feedstock because we want that moisture content to be 10% or lower before we go into the decrystallization phase. And so there's a way of capturing that water that you're boiling off. We'll be doing that in our project in Mississippi. And so the water usage is in fact, lower than what you would have in a conventional grain-based ethanol plant.
It sounds to me as if the production facilities are pretty close to right, and that you can make that work. Where's the bottleneck, if anything, and what size facility do you think works well? I know you're talking 19 million gallons. Ethanol production facilities are much larger. Most of them that are sited now are at least 100 and probably closer to 250 million gallons a year. Is the bottleneck and the problem collection of the input stock, and does that keep sizes small in terms of the facility, do you think?
Absolutely. And that is truly the bottleneck I see that a lot of our competitors are struggling with also. It really gets into what's called the energy density unit. If you think about the corn itself, you know, you have kernels, they have cars that can move those kernels into a plant. The corn, while it's a bulk commodity, has a very high energy content per the small kernel, and it packs well. When you think about harvesting, though, a rice straw or a wheat straw or a corn stover, it's pretty bulky, but there's a lot of air that surrounds it, even if you're trying to compact it into a bale or however you're doing the corn stover. And so consequently, what you have is has very low energy content per unit volume. And so what limits you is, first of all, the bulk material that you have to move around to get it into the plant. It's much higher bulk than what you would have, say, with corn. But secondarily, as you're well aware, you can store corn because you get it down to a smaller size. You have corn, storage silos all over the country. In the case of biomass materials, you don't have that storage capability in terms of designated areas to store it or process it or whatever. And you have a very narrow window in which you're trying to harvest this residue out of the fields. Or even if you have a purpose-grown energy crop, you have to get that out of the fields and then find some place to store it so the plant can operate it on a year-round basis. And so what ends up happening with these constraints right now, and here's maybe the third constraint, is a lot of, in many, many cases, the equipment does not exist right now to harvest efficiently these agricultural residues because we normally in the past haven't done that. So consequently, you have to have new equipment that's only going to be used for a very short period of time in the year, specifically for harvesting that type of biomass. Then you have to find some place to store it off-site because you're looking at hundreds of acres of storage requirements for, say, feeding even a 20 million gallon a year ethanol plant. So that's another issue. And then thirdly, it's the cost of bringing that material from the field to the plant. And so typically what we're looking at and what we've experienced, because we will be doing agricultural residues as well as purpose-grown crops plants in the future. As a matter of fact, we're looking at two of them right now. One of them is a rice straw ethanol plant that we worked on many, many years ago up in Sacramento. You're limited to a gathering radius of about 50 miles before your transportation costs, your storage issues, and all that overrun the ability of the plant to economically pay for that particular feedstock. So consequently, when you look at it, you're in a very bad situation, from a unit volume, again, energy density side. And so you're probably limited at the most to maybe a 50 million gallon a year ethanol plant if you have feedstock that's high in cellulose. And so that really, again, is the other thing, because you have cellulose and hemicellulose content, but then you have lignin, and many of these crops have a very high lignin content and a lower cellulose content, and the cellulose is where you get the sugars from. So it varies on field by field, but I think a big plant is going to be 50, 55 million gallons a year.
We're talking this afternoon with the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol about cellulosic ethanol in the industry and its development. His name is Arne Klon. More with him when we return here on The Farming World.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, government sources in Japan say that Japan is not ruling out currency intervention as an option to curb excess yen rises. Japanese policymakers have tried to stem the yen's gains with verbal intervention that failed to keep traders from pushing the yen to a fresh 15-year high against the dollar and a 9-year peak against the euro on Tuesday. Burger King, the number two U.S. hamburger chain, forecast weak demand for its new fiscal year amid a struggling economy and says that it is unsure how costs for key ingredients like beef will impact the company. Burger King says that net income fell to $49 million, or 36 cents a share, in the fourth quarter that ended June 30th, from $58.9 million, or 44 cents a share, a year earlier. Worldwide sales at restaurants open at least 13 months were down 0.7%. That included a 1.5% drop in the United States and Canada. TransUnion today reports that the amount that consumers owed on their credit cards dropped to its lowest level in 8 years. The average combined debt for bank-issued credit cards, those with a MasterCard or Visa logo, fell to $4,951 in the second quarter, down 13% from last year. The credit card agency says that it was the first time debt fell below $5,000 since the first quarter of 2002. And that's a look at today's business news. In agriculture,
support.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Arnie Klon. He's the CEO and the president of Blue Fire Ethanol. You can visit them online if you'd like. I believe the address is bluefireethanol.com. Correct me if that's wrong, Mr. Klon. And when we left you last, we had gotten to the point where you suggested that the proper sizing or the largest size of a production facility might be about 50 million gallons. That's much smaller than a corn-based ethanol. 50 is kind of a common number, 50 miles for the collection point for all of the stover, whether that's a plant that's grown directly for use or whether it's collected from some other place. Does this make cellulosic ethanol a niche market or a smaller market than corn-based ethanol by default, or does it just mean in the future you think there will be far more cellulosic ethanol plants distributed across the country?
Well, I think it's going to be, frankly, the factor that's going to be limiting the growth of the marketplace will be really the availability of feedstock. You'll have a lot more plants of the cellulosic type of plants than you do in the corn-based plants to get to the same volume that corn is producing. And, of course, under a renewable fuel standard that was passed back in 2008 and then 2009 again, you know, that's a 16 billion gallon a year designated marketplace by 2022 for cellulosic. Of course, corn is capped at 15 billion gallons a year for a total of 31 billion gallons a year of ethanol coming into the marketplace here in the United States domestically by 2022. So the cellulosic market in terms of a designated market is out there, you know, and that target is at 16 billion gallons a year. But you're going to see, to be able to achieve that 16 billion gallons a year, you're going to have double to triple the number of ethanol plants you have today. You know, just on a comparison basis, because again, unless you have a methodology for getting a higher unit density of feedstock, okay, and that's where the purpose-grown energy crops come in, because in fact, they have a lot more cellulose and hemicellulose entrained in the plant than say you would get from utilizing an agricultural residue type of thing. But you're still going to be limited, really, in the gathering and collection. I mean, that's really the bottleneck in the cellulosic plants. Now, for some farmers that, you know, we have talked to, they see, you know, the opportunity here because it really does add to the farmer's bottom line to be able to harvest that residue out of the field, to be able to put it in a position where it can be then utilized by the cellulosic plant. And so I think over time, as the infrastructure starts getting built, because bear in mind what we're talking about here for cellulosic ethanol is something that does not have a feedstock infrastructure that exists other than in experimental stage right at the moment. And I think once the people that really know how to handle this material, and by the way, that's the farmers, once they figure out what's a cost-efficient way of doing it, you might be able to build slightly larger plants. But again, it's just this energy density issue in the collection that really is going to limit the size of the plant.
If you had your choice, what would be the feedstock?
That's a very good question. Right now, you know, we've tested a lot of feedstocks. I think the optimum business model, okay, is sugarcane. And the reason why I say that is if you look at sugarcane itself and don't use conventional harvesting, but, you know, where they burn the cane fields and then harvest the billets, but rather harvest the whole plant, bringing that into the processing facility, and then, you know, you would have basically the processing of the billet of the, you know, the conventional methodology for recovering the sugars from the billet of cane. And then the residues that would be left over, which would be the leaves, the tops, the bagasse, you know, after they've squeezed the sugar out of it, and then take that and process that into, you know, or remove the sugars from all of that biomass material, you would just about triple the production of ethanol out of a conventional grain, cane-based facility. So, you know, we see that as kind of the optimum. The next optimum probably is again, if you come up with a different harvesting processing technique for corn, where, again, instead of just harvesting, you know, the heads of the corn, is you harvest the whole plant and then separate it out in your factory, you know, where what goes where, because the corn cob, everything in the plant can then be processed into producing that ethanol. And I don't know the exact number of the sugar content in terms of the stalk and what the ear would have in terms of the cob and that, but it would be at least double what you're getting out of a conventional corn-based ethanol plant.
Mr. Klon, thank you so much for joining us today. Any final word on Blue Fire and the experience that you've had?
Well, I think we should be excited as Americans because we have a technology that doesn't rely on foreign imports to meet our energy needs in this country. And I think the farmers working together, you know, we see this as a partnership throughout the United States in which we can produce a whole new energy source. And by the way, you know, we're focusing on ethanol today. But in fact, we can produce, we're working with a company called Solazyme, where we're producing biodiesel and biojet fuels. And there's other companies out there where you can not only from the corn produce the ethanol, but you can produce what's necessary to run the tractors, to run the jet engines that fly on the wings of airplanes and even do power generation today. I mean, we have something here that we can fundamentally change the econometric model of this country, and that's to go away from petroleum and go to a carbohydrate econometric model. So we should all be excited, and we should all be working together to try to make this happen.
That's Arne Klon. He's with Blue Fire Ethanol at bluefireethanol.com. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World.